I'll try and keep this fairly concise because it's a topic I could probably talk about for most of the day from various different perspectives. But really what I wanted to focus on a little bit is sort of the changing data economy and a series of challenges which are sort of thrown up by that. And some of the work that we've been doing within our research group to try and address those challenges. So these are the three takeaways, and I'll refer to those at the end of the talk as well. I would argue that the way in which we'll do quantitative social science in the future is changing and will change. And I think that's evident from everything we've heard today so far and yesterday. But in particular, the data assets that we've traditionally used as social scientists are increasingly under threat for a variety of reasons. I've got three examples of that. And at the same time, there's lots of other new and interesting new forms of data, which, again, we've heard various examples of, which can be used to inform social sciences. Because of all those issues, there's a desperate need for new infrastructure and training. So this sets up some of the challenges, which I'll just go through briefly and then just describe a little bit of what we've been doing in Liverpool around those. So the first one, certainly when I was trained as a geographer in GIS and doing basic quantitative analysis in my undergraduate degree, the only data set I think we ever used was census data. And there are a great number of academics who still get very excited when the census comes out and they produce the same papers that they produced for the last census and they show some incremental change and, you know, kudos to them. But I was never very interested in the census, so unfortunately I've had to use all these difficult data sets with these complex problems, and it's probably made my life a lot more difficult. But the census itself has got problems. In some countries, censuses have been scrapped. In the UK, we have this issue of sort of every time a census comes round and the bean counters work out how much it's cost, there's increasing scrutiny on whether there'll be another one, and we just get away with it each time. But I think that is going to run out at some point. And there's big efforts being put into administrative censuses. And the censuses themselves evolve. So, I mean, in the US, there's been issues in the past couple of weeks about citizenship questions being added in and the impact that might have on response rates, which will have all sorts of implications if that sort of goes ahead. So census data, I think, is problematic. The other data set that social scientists have liked to use are surveys, some of them fairly large. And there's a growing concern across a breadth of the academic community around response rates to these surveys. And again, these have implications of what kind of inferences you can make from them and the confidence of which you can create estimates. So there's a whole variety of academic publications about response rates in different types of surveys, longitudinal surveys. But this graph, I think, is quite useful to illustrate it. I came across this when I was giving a talk last year. Someone had put in a Freedom of Information request to the Office for National Statistics to get the response rates for a series of their large surveys over a 10-year period. And you can actually see for most of these surveys, it drops in response rates about 20 percentage points, which is actually quite startling. And it does seem to be a downward trajectory. So, you know, if this pattern continues, and it may not, these surveys are going to likely be less useful than they were in the past. The other set of data, which I think, you know, we probably all come across, are open data. And they're fairly prevalent in lots of different domains, from sort of education, health, legal documents, all sorts of different things. This is an example from the US, which I like to use. So you probably know what's coming next. That happened, then that happened. Data assets that were available one day, well, I think it was 2 days after he got elected, they disappeared. But you get the idea, these things don't necessarily exist in perpetuity. Example from the UK comes from the Valuation Office Agency. They've got a series of functions, but one of the things that we have in the UK, if you own a business or a retail shop, you have to pay some sort of local taxation on the basis of the size of these units. And these are the organisation who collect that data and do the assessments about how much you pay. And it used to be that data, you could type in an address, you could see what your shop's rateable value was, you could see what your neighbour's shop's rateable value was, And all of that data was supplied under what we call in the UK an open government license, which basically means it's open data, the formal definition of open data. You couldn't get it all in bulk. It was quite difficult to get access to. And then I was really excited. We got this, well, this 1990s website was replaced by this nice new shiny one. I was like, great. And the great thing about this was this bulk download. You can go and get CSVs of the whole of the data set. You can do lots of interesting sort of GIS analysis on it. The problem was they completely changed the license terms. So exactly the same data now available in bulk, but there was no longer any open government license. So it was no longer open data. And there's a very complicated, dull history about some problems with addressing in the UK of why this has happened. But there's been a series of instances like this where previously open data were changed in terms of their licenses, which meant it was much more difficult to use those for, even for academic purposes. So actually these data can only really be used for the administrative purposes for which the data were collected, which is a real shame because I've actually got great research value. People have built businesses, and I know people have got businesses with products which they've created. Maybe they invested a year of their life in building something around these data, could no longer sell those products, and they've been scrapped. So there are ripples in sort of lots of different ways. So these are kind of the problems, the moans of things that are happening. This is what we've been doing in this area to try and make things a bit better. As I said at the start, there's lots of these new forms of data. In our case, we've been particularly interested in engaging with retailers and other consumer data organisations of how they can open up their data assets to an academic community where we have things like more stable licences, and as mechanisms by which a researcher can get access to the data, we sort of take into account the privacy constraints of those attributes contained within those data and also the commercial sensitivities about having those data outside of the organisations who've collected them. So we operate something called the Consumer Data Research Centre, and we've got fairly robust... Okay, good. I'll take my time. We've got robust governance procedures where any researchers can apply to use the data, and we've got a series of different access mechanisms by which people can get go and do their own projects on the data that these consumer organisations have provided. We do that in the most sort of secure sense. We've got a kind of a sort of cage where we've got all this data that sits in a sort of prison cage and a private secure network to a sort of closed lab like you might have if you're using sort of census microdata. And then we've got a series of other platforms which are more open that enable you to go on. We've got a mapping platform, so you can actually map a lot of the attributes at safe levels of aggregation. And we aggregate the data into what we call data products, where we'll tend to mix some of the commercially sensitive data with other open data sources, with agreement with the data partner, and create products that we can disseminate with open licenses. And we find that's quite a good way of taking some of these assets and putting them into the public domain. But if you really did want to, you know, use the data in its rawest form, you can actually go into our secure lab and do that as well. So this requires quite a lot of investment. So it's not a cheap solution, but it is quite a useful solution that you can actually mitigate some of these problems and open up access more broadly to some of these data sets that aren't necessarily in the public domain via any other sort of mechanisms. The second thing that we've been doing relates to training. So you need the infrastructure, which is both the hardware and the people to manage the hardware and the software to run the analytics. And you also need people who can actually go and use it. Again, we're successful in getting some funding for a PhD program, which was specifically designed to take social scientists who could have some interesting sort of quantitative social science, but wouldn't necessarily have any advanced data science skills, and they may not have done any coding or know anything about databases. So it's a 4-year PhD program with an integrated master's. And we have 4 integrated modules which essentially aim to provide that context for the students in their first year of the programme. And then that leaves the remaining years of the programme whereby they kind of go through. I think we've got funding for about 50 students over the next 3 years. So it's a fairly significant investment. And each of the projects work with one of these commercial partners, and many of the data sets that they've got actually get integrated into these infrastructure that I mentioned previously as well. So I'll just leave these, but essentially I'm finished.